listening to Tidings, and this is Hazel Kahn. Today I'll be talking about pilgrimages and pilgrims. In my untutored mind, pilgrims were people from ancient times, and pilgrimages were old, medieval, Christian things, irrelevant to our day and age. I'm glad to say that Stephanie Dale's book, My Pilgrim's Heart, corrected all of this. Now I know that pilgrims are not only very much wandering around today, but that all leading world religions have them. In my ignorance, I hadn't connected. The Hajj pilgrimage made by devout Muslims to Mecca and Medina hadn't connected that to El Camino de Santiago de Compostela for Christians, to the Holy Land for all of the Abrahamic faiths, Muslims, Jews, and Christians. And of course, Sikh pilgrims go to Amritsar and the Golden Temple, Hindus go to the Ganges River, and Tibetan Buddhists go to Dharamsala. Now I see pilgrimages as a spiritual counterpoint to the dark tourism destinations that I've explored in an earlier Tidings program. Let me see what Stephanie Dale has to say about this. Stephanie, tell me about your pilgrimage from Rome to Jerusalem. Just some facts at first. You walked hundreds of miles.
Mm-hmm. I walked 1,000 miles, Hazel. I walked across Italy, through the Balkans, and then a year later flew to the Middle East. In 2007, my son was walking from Canterbury in England to Jerusalem. In the end, over 9 months, he walked 5,000 miles through 16 countries. And I was quite intrigued by the notion of walking across Italy, purely the romance of the idea. And so I took advantage of Ben doing this walk to fly to Rome and meet him there. And I set my compass for Istanbul. I got quite carried away with the romance of the idea. And in the end, I walked with him 1,000 miles across Italy, then through the Balkans. And a year later, I went home after Tirana in Albania. And a year later, flew to the Middle East to meet him and walk with him for the final leg into Jerusalem.
You know, your book is quite detailed about the various ways you got around. And, you know, it's very vivid in terms of describing the different transportation things. Because you were okay with going on buses or trains or something if you really wanted to do that. But he was quite pure, let's say, about just never back. He would backtrack on some other form of transportation, but otherwise he would only walk. Is that right?
Yeah, that's quite correct. He was committed to walking every step of the way. I was not. However, I did do most of every step on the way. I think I caught buses or a train maybe 50 miles out of the 1,000. He made two concessions to common sense. That's how I describe them, i.e. the water. He got a ferry across the English Channel, and he caught a ferry with me with him across the Adriatic Sea. And that otherwise it would have been another something like 1,000 miles for him if he hadn't caught that ferry across the Adriatic.
Oh, then he would have had to walk around, you mean? Or
would have had to walk around, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So did that make you different? Well, did that make you and Ben different kinds of pilgrims?
No, not really. The transport that I caught was really early in the journey when my feet were blistered. He had already done a couple of thousand miles by the time we met in Rome. And when I set out with him, my feet were new to the journey. And so within, say, 48 hours, I had some pretty awful blisters going, and also some pretty pathetic complaining going on. Ben, with all these miles under his belt, had just learned, he transcended the pain and the misery of it, and I was right in it. So the way we negotiated that, because obviously he's a lot younger and fitter than me, is that I jumped on a bus quite early in the journey to get from A to B, just little legs there. But really, you know, this was the second pilgrimage Ben and I had done together. We'd walked the Camino 2 years previously, and we both were committed to walking every step of that. And I applied that as much as I could with common sense to the journey from Rome, simply because I understand the transformational aspects that are available to us as human beings by keeping on going with the walking. That commitment changes something alchemically in our spiritual makeup, if you like. And I knew that that was available to me if I committed to the walk aspect.
I see. That's interesting. So, because that's what I was going to ask about. I mean, your book is very honest and frank about the blisters, about the blisters and all the discomforts of the rain and the row. I mean, sleeping on rocks or, you know, sleeping in awful places and tents collapsing on you and all those things and food. I mean, you never seem to have enough food. You're always eating chocolate and oranges, as far as I can tell.
Well, yes, a part of the reason for that is I'm a vegetarian. It is very difficult in Europe and the Balkans and countries like that for people to make sense of the word vegetarian. They don't get it. So my diet was knowingly bread and cheese and chocolate and mandarins. I knew that was going to be the case, and I found it quite delicious. And for me, it was a bit of humor through the book that, you know, oh, it's time for dinner, bread, cheese, chocolate, mandarins. The other aspects, like the tents collapsing and stuff, it is really all part of the journey. For some people, that will be difficult when they read it. For others, it's just hysterically funny. For me, it's just part of the journey, and that's what pilgrimage teaches you to do. It teaches you to meet life exactly as it is, and if there is a problem, to solve it, to take steps towards it, or else just put up with it. And the thing about the weather, I love being outside all day, every day. That is one aspect of pilgrimage I just love, is from sun up to sundown and well into the night at times if no accommodation is available. You're just outside walking. It's like walking the turning wheel. And, you know, it broke my heart, both pilgrimages, when I realized it was done and I had to go back inside. It's a glorious thing to meet. To even to walk in the rain, even to walk in the snow, even to walk in the wind or the hot, you know, it teaches you that everything passes. One minute it will be too hot, but the next it will be too cold. The point is that it is what it is, and we learn to meet life exactly how it is. And those lessons have served me so well in the rest of my life.
Because one of the things that I always thought about pilgrimages is that it was also the destination that counted, because if you think about it, all these pilgrimages, old, you know, universal, ancient or modern or other religions, you know, whether it's Medina or Mecca for Muslims, whether it's the Wailing Wall for Jews or Hebron, or there's always a destination. And so I am a little bit confused. Maybe you can talk about the difference or the relationship between the journey and the actual destination.
That's a really wonderful question, Hazel. The destination is just the light on the hill. There is no there. I remember quite specifically it was day 25 of the Camino where all three of us that were walking together, every single step was an agony. And that's when I realized I have to come back to this moment. There is no there. There is no end. There is this light on the hill called Santiago de Compostela, but it is irrelevant to day 25 when my only obligation, where all my energy is required, just to pick up one foot and put it in front of the other. And I certainly had to reapply those lessons to the journey from Rome with my son Ben. It's an incredible thing, and this is one of the lessons that I carry with me. I have never, ever forgotten this. Now I've done two pilgrimages. It's in my bones. There is no there. There is no goal. There is absolutely no goal. There are lights on the hill, and I'm walking towards that light. But the only thing that requires my attention is what's here today, right now. What do I need to do? Do anything more is exhausting.
And what's interesting, what I'm thinking as I'm listening to you, is that you had maps. You had mainly paper maps. You didn't have...
Didn't really even have much of a map, to be honest.
You didn't have much of a map, and you didn't have... The borders in a lot of these countries, especially in the Balkans, were sort of undefined. So sometimes you didn't know which side of the border you were on.
No, that's very true. And those things are connected, the absence of maps and where are the borders. One of the reasons for that is we live in a driving culture. The 21st century is a driving world. So the maps that are available to us are maps for cars. So it's very difficult to find small-scale maps that are made for walking, especially if you don't want to stick to these massive highways and freeways, which when you're walking, you really don't. You're looking for the tracks. And this meant that we had to make an awful lot of it up as we went along.
And the borders were shifting anyway, or had shifted. Right, because it's that part of the world where there have been all these wars and new countries have been formed. Can you talk about those countries a little bit?
The first thing I'll throw in there is that just a glimpse of what it's like to be a pilgrim. The time it would take you to drive an hour in a car takes us 3 days to walk. And because Ben was committed to walking and I was committed to walking just about all the way with him, it meant that whatever we needed had to be within walking distance at the end of the day when you're tired and, you know, there's not a lot of resources left to go and get what you might need. What this means is that the world around us is only as visible as far as our naked eye can see. That's all we've got. We're also talking about pre-smartphones. So we didn't have, you know, Google Maps to tell us where the nearest restaurant was or the nearest hotel or something. The only information we had, bearing in mind that we didn't speak the languages around us, although we did a pretty good job of pidgin communication, our world is only as big as what is visually available to us, which meant that we weren't really sure where borders were. We came across them when we came across them. We had an idea in a day, you know, we'd find some internet and look at our computers and work out, oh, you know, maybe we're a day from the Bosnian border. But the moment we actually met it was always going to be a mystery to us until we did find it. And, you know, when it comes to countries and shifting borders, there was some, you know, one particularly heartbreaking moment when we were walking into Albania and the people before we got there started clapping us and asking, are we going to Albania? This always makes me cry, so you'll have to excuse me if I choke up a bit. They were just so pleased that we were obviously Westerners and we were going to Albania. And these were people that the line in the sand had been drawn and they were on the other side of it. So they were in Montenegro. They weren't in Albania, whereas, you know, sometime not so long ago, perhaps they were in Albania. It was an extraordinary thing to meet people at that most basic level. You know, and every now and again we nudged up against politics, and that was one of those moments. It was an extraordinary thing to think that the fact that we could walk into Albania was something that people might clap us for.
But they were pleased because they were originally from Albania, or nobody ever visits Albania, just the idea of having guests, or, you know, what was so pleasing to them?
I can only tell a story about what was pleasing, but my story that I tell about why I think it was pleasing to them is that we were clearly from the West. Mm. So we were observers. We were here to see. We were here to say, we see you. Albania is heartbreakingly forgotten.
It is a forgotten place, isn't it? If it was ever even known before it was forgotten. You know, I mean...
That's right. We didn't even know it was there to forget
it. Yeah, yeah.
But having a look at it, you know, Ben and I were just jaw-dropping about the poverty in the middle of Europe. It is shameful that red, the place looks like it's a war zone, and it's not a war zone. And that was the paradox. You know, here we are, we've walked through these countries that have been war zones and in various stages of recovery. But clearly Albania wasn't quite a war zone, but it was just a mess of rubble. Mm. And the people are living like that.
But to go back to the borders thing, I mean, obviously you had to go through checkpoints and so on, border control, passport control at some time, but I think sometimes you didn't really have to.
Albania was a case in point. Mm. We got to the border. The soldiers were more intrigued with our cameras than anything else. And so they were taking photographs of everybody, having taken Ben's camera off him. And then they waved us on, and we are still holding up our passports. So we handed over our passports. They passed them round each other and gave them back without anybody looking inside them. It was very funny.
When I read that, it made me think another thing is that, you couldn't even really ask people, what country is this? Because sometimes the names of the countries are so different in their own language or in signs that you saw on the road, you didn't even know which country it was.
It was amazing. Croatia, the people of Croatia call themselves, and my pronunciation is shocking, but the people of Croatia call themselves Hrvatska. The people of Montenegro call themselves Crna Gora. And the people of Albania call themselves Skwiperia. But I've often wondered why it is we don't call people what they call themselves. And the people, I asked that to the people of Croatia, and they said that it was a condition of EU status, that they call themselves Croatia. So, you know, clearly it's political. Mm. I have no idea why.
This is Tidings from Hazel Khan, where Stephanie Dale is talking about her new book, My Pilgrim's Heart.
But I just want to refer to Carl J. Jung, because he's a psychologist that I'm very interested in. And he talks about that the outer journey reflects the inner journey, and in the significance of passing through territories that are not your own. Now, from your descriptions in your book, from the Italy you traveled through to through the Balkan countries that you mention, you describe actually in very vivid terms, very detailed terms, the terrain of each of these countries and how it changes. And I think the point here is that with it, your own internal terrain changes too, so that different fears or dreams might be evoked when you're going through Albania than when you're going through Croatia. I don't know if I got that right or not.
Yeah, look, totally, Hazel. It was one of the extraordinary aspects of this journey was looking at how the world reflected my world. And by the time I finished the journey, and it was only when I was writing the book that I realized that, I was totally obsessed with the war within and the war without when I was walking through the Balkans. And I was quite consciously journeying these various states of rubble and honesty and dishonesty and what was visible and the politics of lines in the sand. But I could mirror that in myself. And by the time I got to the Middle East, I realized that I was my mind was more obsessing about the veil, the world behind the mystery, behind the veil, which was mirrored to me by the Middle East. And, you know, and I think that that's one of the enormous gifts of pilgrimage is the opportunity to not just think, but to get right down in the mud of our lives and get honest with ourselves. Because let's face it, when you walk 1,000 miles, you don't have much else to do but just gaze around you and get to know yourself. And that brings us to the question, the early part of that question you just asked, which is, what is pilgrimage? There's the definition of pilgrimage, which is walking towards the light on the hill, whatever your light on the hill may be. And it's that definition, the act of walking every single day, no matter how you feel, no matter what the weather, it's that definition of pilgrimage that will lead us deep, deep, deep into the insights that change our world and change our relationship to our world. Because you really can't escape the fact that the world mirrors who we are.
Can you talk a little bit more about, I remember one part of your book, before you ever got to, I guess it was Croatia or Bosnia or whatever it was, you were worried, you were terrified of landmines. You were preoccupied with the possibility of landmines. I don't know if you ever actually encountered a landmine. I don't know. So when you realized there weren't any landmines, did that change? Or are you talking about what the terrain, which I'm calling the terrain, the landscape, some specific times when you recognize something about yourself?
The landmine became a metaphor. From the moment I decided to go on that journey with Ben, I did not want to know what route he would choose. I knew he was going to choose the Balkans, and it's the last place on earth I would go if I was not following my son on his journey, and I had to surrender to the fact that this was his journey. So I never asked him. I stuck with, I am going walking across Rome, and then, you know, maybe we'll get, you know, walk through Greece to Istanbul or something. I knew he would choose the Balkans. And whenever I got real about that in the weeks leading up to leaving for Rome, I had these landmines going off in my head. I was convinced I was going to get done in by a landmine. And, of course, you know, Ben tells me we're going to walk through Bosnia, and I'm thinking, oh, you know, here I go. And I think the point of this is that these are the kinds of stories that keep us sitting on the lounge, that keep us from getting up, and certainly myself, that keep me from getting up and going and getting my life. So in my case, the metaphor became landmines, but I'm sure just about all of us have our fear stories. And mine just happened to take the shape of landmines. And the further I got into those countries, the more the reality, you know, it's like walking my deepest fears and walking through them, because they're just stories and they're baseless stories. They're headlines that my mind has kind of gripped onto as some kind of overarching reason why I should not do something I'm really longing to do.
So discipline, you used the word discipline. I don't think you used it anywhere in the book, actually, but it's a word that certainly I thought of. Discipline versus just being a wuss, being wimpy, just caving in. But then I thought, but you know, that's probably true of so many things in life, true of any human endeavor in a way, any time when exertion is required or stamina is required. Or
discipline was sorely lacking in my life. As a child of the post-60s generation, we were the generation that came in the wake of that enormous change, where we didn't have the cause. So I consider us the undisciplined generation, right at the tail end of the baby boomers. And I really had to learn discipline. Pilgrimage gave me discipline. It taught me how to keep going no matter what. And it coded it into my bones, how to keep going.
Well, again, knowing where the borders lie, maybe.
Knowing where the borders lie and knowing where my own borders lie.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask you, I'm sure this is one of the things that people always ask you about, is and being the mother of a son, I ask especially, how on earth could you travel with your son? I mean, not how on earth could you, but how did you travel, and how was that for you? I mean, because in your book, you're quite honest about the times when he upset you or hurt your feelings, and other times when you did a lot of playing backgammon together. So that was a very, you know, a nice thing that you did together. You had all the time was the backgammon. You were always playing backgammon, taking out your board and playing backgammon. But I was just wondering, you know, when you talked about things like you called him, he did blog sport, which is a very clever way of talking about what he was doing. Talk about that. I mean, talk about just what it was like to be like this with your son.
Well, you know, Hazel, it's only in hindsight that I realize this is a really uncommon journey for a mother and an adult son to share, this kind of journey. And one of the great gifts of the pilgrimage was the maturing of myself as a mother and he as a son. I wanted him just to tell everybody what a great person I was. And he wasn't not doing that. There's a point towards the end of the book where he and I actually get lost in the desert. And to me, it's quite a beautiful metaphor that we were lost in a biblical desert. And we weren't ever really that lost, because a day in any direction is going to lead you to civilization. But we did spend a night on the stones watching Orion wheel across the sky. I find my son's journey heroic. He walked 5,000 miles through 16 countries, most of it alone, and having the courage to walk with his mother as well. You know, it's not like having a friend of, like a peer with you. There would have been a sense of being responsible for me, which was largely unspoken, and I wouldn't have wanted him to feel responsible for me, but of course he did. You know, there would have been all kinds of dynamics going on. I mean, I really didn't explore them as deeply as I might have. And, you know, the one person who I gave complete right of veto on that manuscript before it was published was my son.
Yeah, how old was he actually when you started?
He was 29. He was 29 when we did the walk. Mm-hmm. Turning 30, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where is he now?
He joined the army.
Really?
He'd been travelling for 10 years and he knew he wanted to join the Australian Army. And I think this journey was his swan song to life on the road, his way of exhausting himself with travel so that he was happy to go and do something. Speaking of discipline, a little more disciplined. Yeah.
A different kind of discipline anyway.
A radically different kind, one extreme to the other. Hey?
Well, the army discipline, I would say, was coming from the outside, and the other, and the pilgrimage discipline was coming more from the inside, maybe.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you, I have two more questions for you. One is, what made you decide to self-publish? Had you looked into trying to get an agent and go the conventional route with agents and publishers, or did you decide from the beginning to self-publish?
Well, I made no decision to. I didn't even think about publishing, and this was a conscious act, until I'd finished the manuscripts, because I knew that that was going to be a very different part of my brain than the, you know, that delicious creative zone that is writing. So I wrote two manuscripts while I had the space and the time to write. I wrote two books. And then the time came to publish. And do you know, Hazel, I could not be bothered spending 2 years knocking on doors, asking important people behind a very big castle wall whether or not they were interested in publishing my work. So that's what led me to publish them myself, which is what I did in Australia. And then a year ago, almost a year to the day, actually, I came to New York City with, I gave myself a month, and I decided that I wanted a publisher. And I came to New York to find a publisher for the US version of the book, which I did. It was just released this month in the US. So I guess I sit on both sides of the self-publishing, traditional publishing fence, and there are pros and cons to both.
Well, let me ask you, if people want to know then more about you, they should go to stephaniedale.net, right? That's where...
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's my website, and it's pretty full with various creative projects I have on the boil.
So now it's, what is it? It's June, and you said you're going to be here another 6 weeks, you told me earlier. Mm-hmm. And then what? Then where do you go?
Well, I'm going to go to Europe. My mother, you'll love this story. My mother is 82, and she is the Australian tennis champion for the over 80s. And she's competing in the World Super Seniors Tennis Championships in Croatia in September. So I'll go over to Europe and meet my mother and, fly the flag and cheer her on.
I bet you didn't think you'd be back to Croatia except the second time.
No, I didn't. I didn't, actually.
So the other question then is what about, aren't you going to go home? I mean, you're Australian and mm-hmm. I guess you live in Australia, or are you not going to go back home, or...?
I don't want to go home for a long time. I'm learning to leave home. My grandchildren are in their teens, and even though I love to travel, I always scurry home because I love being around them. And I feel, you know, I've stayed home for a generation and a half. I really want to learn to leave home. So I have my walking boots and my pack in my suitcase. And if I find the need to scurry home, before I do, I'll do another pilgrimage, maybe a smaller one, a month. And then if I still want to go home because I want to go home, then I will. But there's a very good chance I may want to stay out here. Australia is a long way away from the Northern Hemisphere, and it's very expensive to get out. So it's not like we just go home and fly right out again as the whim takes us. I'd really like to travel for a while and do everything that I'd love to do before I head home again.
Thank you very much, Stephanie. It was great. I really enjoyed hearing about all these things.
Well, thank you for your interest.
Thank you very much.
Just heard Stephanie Dale talking about her new book, My Pilgrim's Heart. Tidings can be heard on the second Wednesday of every month at 7:30 p.m., right after Free Speech Radio News, and archived on hazelkahn.com and wpkn.org. Tidings is produced by Tony Ernst.